of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, the first thing is drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, inserted, the plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
You better believe it. We're going to make this a great country. United States is going to be great again, and great again, great all over. But probably for the rich. I don't think it's going to be much better for the out-of-work people and common man. In the meantime, we can have a lot of chaos, and that's what Tommy likes. Tommy likes chaos. Out of chaos sometimes comes some pretty good things, but sometimes maybe not. But we'll have to wait and see. But without chaos, nothing changes. That's right. What do you think about this Dick Ryan? Not Dick name, Dick, as in penis, Ryan up there, trying to play politics. He's jockeying for something. He's jockeying for something. And now they talk about a third party? Forget it. You know, the third parties never work. Of course, maybe if both the parties agree to let them have a third party, maybe. But no. And now they're ready to say that Hillary, she didn't do nothing wrong. You just picking on Hillary. The FBI looked all over everything. Everything. Could find anything. Oh, wow. Too bad. Well, the date is the 6th of May, 2016, all day, and a bright sunny day here in Indiana, northern Indiana, and that's nice. That's real nice. If it warms up a little more, I'm going to get all my seeds out, start throwing them around. I've already thrown some around, but I don't know whether they're going to go anyplace. I've got a stand of ferns out here by my house. They're beautiful. You can't see them from the road or anything, but they're one spot. I got these big 5-foot, 4-foot ferns, and I'm taking them out of the ground and spreading them around and putting them all over the property. They look really nice. I don't know how they got there, but they come up every spring, big and tall. Now, down at my favorite cheap store where I buy most of my stuff, they've got vegetable seeds and fruit seeds and posy seeds and everything else for twenty for a dollar, 20 packages for a dollar. And so I go in there and buy those cheap seeds, and then I dump them all into one sack. And then I really got something there. Maybe. I like the flowers. Yeah. Because after you're dead, it don't do any good to put flowers around you. You can't smell crap. So you want flowers around you when you're alive, not when you're dead. Boy, these insanity people out here are still going strong. Oh, God, we'll never vote for Trump. We'll never vote for Trump. But more and more they're saying, well, maybe we can talk to him and see what he'll do. Political people are funny. They can call you a son of a bitch one minute, and the next minute they can be kissing your ass. When I won the Democratic nomination for Congress out there, I had guys coming from all over the place that wanted to get on the bandwagon and work for me if I got elected. They come out of the woodwork everywhere, buying me lunch, buying me dinner. Guys that hated me before all of a sudden love me. Yeah. Then once I lost the general election, they were nowhere to be found. Who? Tom who? Tom Metzger who? And this is Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker, She-Wolf Day in the Bunker. So this day is always dedicated to the ladies, the tough ladies, the rough ladies, the good-looking ladies, all combined. I also would like to make Friday Money Day, yeah, about the corruption in money, and something you need to know. because we're going to hear about housing and everything else today, and how, as I said a long time ago when the Soviet system fell, I said that the Wall Street had defeated them in the markets and so forth, and that led to their downfall. But we turned around and imported every bad thing the Soviet Union had socially. Yeah, we did. And now it's coming back to kick our ass. In fact, their Sovietized real estate scams are moving across the Western world now. So we got, what are they? They got the gold mine. We got the shaft. Is that it? Here we go with Max Kaiser, and he's really one of the best as far as I'm concerned. And I think it's he's good enough to share half the program with on the subject he's on today. Let's go.
Max Kaiser, this is the Kaiser Report on June 12th, 1987. Speaking in West Berlin, President Ronald Reagan said, General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate, Mr. Gorbachev. Open this gate, Mr. Gorbachev. Tear down this wall. So dramatic. And so, history ended. The Soviet era of collectivization and scarcity was over. A new magical era of ever-rising prosperity was all our futures. Stacy.
Yes, notice the word that President Reagan used was liberalization. So after 30 years, 40 years of unimpeded liberalization all over the world, we have this headline. Tiny and 1,100 pounds a month, corporate answer to flat sharing in London. The Collective, a new 550-bed tower in Old Oak, billed as a new way to live in London, is the corporate answer to the dilemma facing new workers in the capital hunting for a flat and someone to share the cost. It claims to give tenants the first move in on Monday, a hassle-free collective life similar to student halls of residence, but for people starting out in their career. So it's a 550-bed tower. There's a collective kitchens and bathrooms and living rooms and social areas, and the actual bedrooms are 10 square meters, very tiny, and it's all positive spin. But I want to turn to this propaganda poster from the Soviet Union. There's a website that was like mocking all these propaganda posters throughout history from all over the world, but here's the Soviet one that reminds me of this story. This is, they're mocking the Soviet propaganda poster, building a better tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the message, the Soviet Union is building a better tomorrow, and we've got the modest one-bedroom apartment to prove it. So yeah. Here we have collectivization, as many in the Soviet Union did live in very similar sort of setups, shared living rooms and communal sort of spaces and their own little, you know, bedrooms.
Yeah, it has to be. It's a Sovietization of Britain. Essentially, and the collectivization is becoming the new dominant political theme as the economy continues to shrink and continue to favor kleptocrats at the top. And you have here in the UK an economy that's not competitive whatsoever. Competition is constantly killed by the entrenched oligopolists. And starting a business here is very, very difficult unless you're servicing the clownocracy at the top. You know, the fintech industry started off with noble ambitions in the blockchain space. Then suddenly it's a funnel feeding into Blythe Masters, who's a known entity in this horrid kind of paradigm of collectivization ruled by kleptocrats. And so, yes, people are being forced to live in ever smaller spaces. They're charged a lot of money.
But
of course, the banks will lend them money to be in those spaces.
Yeah.
They'll lend them a lot of money to go to school. The amount of debt that these UK graduates end up with when they graduate has never been higher. It's the highest in the world. That's part of the collectivization, Sovietization of the British economy. All dissent is outlawed. Anybody says anything in the opposing bench is labor, for example. example, they're immediately called by the sitting prime minister a terrorist. That's a Sovietization of the UK. Meanwhile, in the Soviet Union, they're like living large. They're expanding. They're smoking cigars. They're having a good time. And the UK is becoming a backwater.
The former Soviet Union. Now, I want to remind people, because many in our audience might not have even been born then, but back in the 80s, we used to laugh. In America, we used to laugh and think about people in collectivization or lining up for food, standing in lines for hours for food. Now we have food banks all over the UK where people have to line up for hours in order to get food and go back to their little 10 square meter collective living. Now this is the first of these buildings. They're building. This is way out in Willesden Junction over a train station. It's 550 rooms. It was financed by a rich Singaporean family. And they're building another one in East London, way, way out on the edge. But I want to turn to another propaganda poster because, you know, they have the same sort of, like, heroic, sort of patriotic, sort of positive to these. First, I'm going to read a quote from the actual guy who's built this. So he is a Reza Merchant, and he is a graduate of London School of Economics. So here we have, remember, these are economic ideologies, allegedly, that were competing back in the Cold War. And I think it's no coincidence that we're back in Cold War 2.0 just as we start living collectively like this. But he says, our Old Oak development is offering Londoners a fresh and innovative way of living. It's also a much-needed option in the context of the capital's housing crisis. We are changing the way people can choose to live. We're offering a solution that will enable young working Londoners, who are the lifeblood of the UK economy, to live properly, enjoy themselves, and meet like-minded people. Co-living creates a genuine sense of community, alongside access to so many more amenities that you would get in a flat share. And now here is the ground manager, the guy who's actually managing the site, and he talks about, you know, the downfalls of one of the problems of collective living is that, of course, who cleans up in the kitchen and all that stuff. Well, he says all residents will have to become used to living communally and be expected to clean up the kitchens after use. Ultimately, those who repeatedly fail to do so would be ejected, but only after every other avenue has explored. So I'm going to turn to some North Korean propaganda poster. I think this is quite new. And as you see, this housewife admonishing you, turn off the water, don't let it drip. So maybe they could hang this in this collective space, that this commune that people are living on in way over in West London.
So where is this going? Okay, the next step after this will be everyone has to wear the same uniform, like Mao's China or in other, you know, dictatorships from before. They have to wear the same uniform. Then, because it'll become living conditions.
Well, they already do. They wear a beard.
Yeah, well, the living conditions will be so horrid, they'll start putting bars on the windows and locks on the door, of course. That'll be the next step. And then, you know, it's a slippery slope, isn't it? And until you have a problem of how do you keep these humans, you know, alive at the cheapest possible way, then a slave labor will be introduced to do some kind of slave issue to compete with Chinese slave labor. You know, this is where this is all
going.
Well,
it doesn't. So at the time, you know, again, bringing back to the 80s, and a lot of people won't remember it, what we were told is total free market capitalism on our terms, how America does it, and it was actually just all fraud and rentier. So, we don't want to be like the commies, the socialists, and all that stuff, because then if we had that, we'd have to live in a collective commune sort of situation. We'd have to wait in food bank lines. And lo and behold, we have that. So, what have we done that is Soviet-like? The command and control, we have command and control monetary policy, we have command and control military policy. Everything is very similar to what.
Right.
The Soviets
had the idea that the authoritarianism was unlimited. It didn't work. In the post-Reagan era, the idea is that fiat money is unlimited, that you can print fiat money by the trillions, and it has no consequences.
Yes.
It's unlimited resource.
Yes.
And they both led to the same outcome, prison. For the population,
exactly.
Prison.
Imprisoned, and we're imprisoned by debt, and they call it choice. So when people look at this, they say, well, the Soviet Union were forced to do this. Here, you have the choice. I remember the guy who's running this development over in Willesden Junction, he's saying, this is a choice. You have a choice. It's a better choice than living in a dodgy flat share. So here, let's look at some analysis in The Guardian that was done about this story called The Collective, the building called The Collective. Collective living's fine for students, but for everybody else, it stinks. And this person notes that, but perhaps the most most rage-inducing thing about the collective is it will probably work. Yes, it's replacing independent living with an ongoing studenthood, a sort of permalescence. Yes, it's another sign that neither government nor market are going to take any of the radical steps required to actually address the housing crisis or improve the lot of renters, and that both state and private sector are content to offer the next generation a few crumbs for the table. So, but we, the population, have also accepted it. It's just our lot in life, and this is how it is. And a lot of people in communist nations, in North Korea or the Soviet Union or the former communist nations, said this is just our lot in life, until one day they took down that wall. They tore down the wall. And
well,
the wall now is debt.
Anyone who objects is labeled a dissenter, and they're punished severely. And you see it right here in the U.K.,
or they're cut off from the credit grid because, no, remember, that's the wall. That's the wall that controls you is debt, access to credit.
Right. You're off the grid. Now you're homeless. You're living in the street. And so living in a collective prison is a step up from being homeless and being beat up every night and abused and tortured. You want to be a part of the collective, and that's what they do. They all dissent. It's not that people voluntarily join this collective in the U.K. It's that anyone who resists is labeled a dissenter by the state-owned, state-run, state-editorialized media outlets, and then they're cast out.
So let's look back at the U.S., where Ronald Reagan was president, and here we have the collective in the U.K., and in the United States, the U.S. homeownership rate falls again, nearing a 48-year low. The drop dashes hopes it had hit bottom, but economists say the stabilization is still good news. Remember, it has to be patriotic. This is positive news.
What was the first
disaster? So the U.S. home ownership rate hit 48-year low.
All right.
63.5% is the new home ownership rate, down from 63.8% last quarter. So this is the lowest since 1968, before Reagan was even president.
Look, there's a transition that no one's talking about. The way the economy is calculated now, it used to be per household. You say that the certain number of households, and because households, you had the marriage, which is a GDP event. You had the kids, which is a GDP event. You furnished your house. You bought your house.
Household formation.
That's the way economy kind of is modeled for 50, 60, 70 years. But that's gone now. The new model for the home are these things. Okay, the whole economy is based on mobile phones and interacting with your mobile phone. So if you pack thousands of people into a prison cell, but give them a mobile phone, they can still go on Facebook. Facebook stock will still go higher.
Just because
people are on prison doesn't mean Facebook stock's not going to go higher.
Let's look at the actual propaganda that they're pushing with the positive news is out of this. So they say the continued declines in the home ownership rate in part reflect a growing number of renter households. Some 363,000 new renter households were formed in the first quarter compared with the same last year, about twice as many as 177,000 new owner houses. So that's a household formation. And remember I said that debt credit is that wall that must be torn down? Well, they say still it also appears that factors such as rising home prices, student loans, delays in marriage and childbearing, and uncertainty about buying a home as an investment are weighing on younger households and motivating them to rent instead.
Look, you could have got people on death row going down the green line, ready to be gassed to death, and they would still be making updates on their Facebook page. Okay, that's the economy. There's a billion people a day making updates on their Facebook page. That's the unit of economic metric that needs to be considered when analyzing global economy. That household formation. Nobody's voluntarily forming a household anymore.
They're too
freaking expensive.
They're living collectively. They're living with their parents. They're living in their parents' basement. They're living in their grandparents' attic. They're living anywhere.
They can update their Facebook. The UK state is buggering me. Oh, I got to update my Facebook page. Hey, we got to go to the second half. Back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to go to New York and talk with Dr. Michael Hudson, author of Killing the Host. Hi, Michael. Show us the book.
Okay, here it is.
Oh, yeah. This is a classic. This is an instant classic. Michael Hudson is the guy who knows the history and application of every economic theory that has ever seen the light of day, I think I can state categorically. He also is a balance of payments economist for Chase Manhattan Bank back in the day, when many of the offshore tax and earnings havens were being set up. And I wanted to touch on this today with you, Dr. Michael Hudson. The Panama Papers were greeted with shock and horror by Western media. Their readers were outraged. Governments promised something would be done. Tell us about Panama. When and why was it established, and for what purpose?
Panama was established basically by the oil industry and the mining industry as the home of flags of convenience. Flags of convenience means you're registered in a country where you want to take all of your worldwide profits. And this was done already in the 1920s. Panama's not a real country. It doesn't have its own currency. It uses the U.S. dollar. A real country government has its own currency, has its own tax system. Panama doesn't have an income tax. The same with Liberia. So when I was writing on the balance of payments of the oil industry in 1965, I went to Standard Oil and I asked them, where are your profits made? I can't figure it out. Are they made at the producing end where you make the oil, or are they made at the distribution end with your refineries, all the money you spend to get a refinery and your filling stations? And the treasurer, who was my guide through all of this, said, well, the profits are made right here in my office in New York. We decide where to make it. And it's not at the producing end. And it's not at the distribution end. I said, where is it? He said, well, it's in the international end, the shipping end. And if you look, I said, well, you know, I look at the balance of payment statistics for earnings. I see Europe. I see Latin America. I see Asia. Where do I find where you make them? He said, there, the very end of that column, there's something called international. And international turned out to be Panama, Liberia, countries that really weren't international at all, countries that were part of the U.S. economy. And he said, look, we buy our oil at very, very low prices from the Near East and from other places, at such a low price that these countries don't get very much. And then we charge a huge markup for our the company that hire the ships. They're called sort of shipping affiliates, but they're really shipping companies that arrange for the oil tankers. They charge such a high price to the European refineries and the American refineries that these refineries don't make any profit at all. So the whole of the oil industry's investment doesn't pay an income tax to the producers or to the distributors. All of these profits were made in the tax havens of Panama and Liberia. It's very much like now Apple is making its profits in low tax countries like Ireland and other tax havens. So there's a pretense that despite the fact that all of this capital investment may be made in the United States and in Europe, none of this capital has any rate of return at all. It's run as a charitable operation in order to subsidize the shipping and sales affiliates, which obviously other industries now have taken over the oil industry's practice of declaring its profits in low tax or zero tax economies. And that's how the big corporations of the world and the big industries all sort of managed to become tax exempt.
Right. So what you're describing there is a concept that you describe as laundering earnings, which is different than laundering money. Just expand on that a little bit.
Well, when you launder money, the whole idea is to conceal where it comes from. So if you're an African dictator or a kleptocrat or whatever, you or an American tax dodger, you want to hide, pretend that the money isn't really yours. Otherwise, if you would have the drug cartel in Colombia and Honduras and other places put direct money into an American bank called, Honduras drug cartel account, obviously it would be great. It would be grabbed. So you have what's called a veil of tears with a V-I to a veil of a head and T-I-E-R-S to make to layer so that nobody can see where the money comes from. Well, the oil industry and the mining industry and Apple and other companies are quite straightforward. They have the accounts right out in the open. They declare them. The governments can see them. So they steal the tax money fair and square. All they're trying to do is not conceal who owns the accounts. They're trying to just avoid taxes and launder the earnings so that it all appears to be made in Panama. Well, of course, none of these earnings end up in Panama. They just go through Panama right back to the U.S. Bank accounts, and they go through U.S. branches in Panama or Liberia, or similar countries. So the money really never leaves the United States. It appears to be a balance of payments flow. It appears to be a foreign investment and a dollar inflow, but it really, all the money stays in the United States.
Wow. This could be your next book, The Veil of Tears. The Veil of Tears. It's a brilliant title. It could be a musical on Broadway. All right, Michael Hudson, let me ask you this. All this information in the Panama Papers could have been sussed out or figured out by looking at national accounts.
You could do it in a way if you look at the balance of payments accounts.
Right.
You look at the Federal Reserve Bulletin or the Treasury Bulletin, and you see U.S. Liabilities to their branches abroad, and you look for how much money comes from U.S. branches in Panama, the British West Indies, Liberia, and there are about seven major banking centers. And you can see all of this money coming in to U.S. Branches in these tax money laundering havens and tax havens, and they're all sent in to the head office branch. Now, in 1967, Chase was asked to set up these branches, as were Citibank and others. In 1967, the United States had a balance of payments problem. That was the Vietnam War. The entire U.S. balance of payments deficit in the 1960s and 70s and 50s came from military spending abroad. And the dollar was under pressure. General de Gaulle and Germany and other countries were saying, give us our gold. So the State Department came to Chase, and they said, we want to get all of the money we can from foreign countries. We've decided the most liquid people in the world, the people with the highest savings, are criminals. We want to get the criminal savings, and we want to make U.S. the crime. We want to replace Switzerland and make America is where all the criminal savings ends up. So could you please establish branches there so that we can, the drug dealers in Colombia and Latin America can put their money in these branches in the Caribbean, and then just send it on to our head offices. That will, otherwise, their money is going to go to Switzerland and Europe, and the Swiss franc and European currencies will go up against the dollar. We want to base the dollar really on criminal capital inflow. Could you, Michael, make an estimate of how much you think we could get by pulling money away from where it's now going into Switzerland and London and Europe and other countries? So that was my job for a little while, to make an estimate of how to make America the criminal center. And one result was that Congress had that time a 15% income tax withholding of foreign investment in Treasury securities. Well, Congress said, look, if we you can't tax the criminals, because if you try to tax them, they're going to put their money somewhere else. So they abolished the 15% withholding tax on income from Treasury securities, just so that the criminals could end up investing in Treasury bonds, and which are the safest investment, and keep their money safe.
Right. I mean, you mentioned something just a moment ago, which I just want to repeat. What people talk about in terms of Panama and the scandal that's happening there with all this offshore money, as you point out, it's really no different than what Apple Computer does through their proxy in Ireland. And correct?
Yes.
All right. So, I mean, that's a go ahead.
Ireland has a 15% tax. Panama doesn't have any tax. And in Ireland, it's not secret as to who owns the accounts. In Panama, it is, because the accounts come via, they all end up in Delaware corporations or Nevada corporations, but they go through the Cayman Islands. Riga, Latvia is one of the centers that post-Soviet capital goes through. There are all sorts of centers people go through before it ends up in Delaware or Nevada, and then in the New York banks.
All right, let's move on to another topic. Saudi Arabia recently threatened to dump $750 billion in U.S. assets should the U.S. reveal the 28 redacted 9/11 pages. So what impact, if any, would such a move have, Dr. Michael Hudson?
Well, in 1975, Herman Kahn and I went to the White House to discuss the oil and the balance of payments. And the Assistant Treasury Secretary explained to us that they told Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries after the oil war that they could charge as much as they want. When America quadrupled the price of grain, OPEC responded by quadrupling the price of oil. And so there was a little bit of a fury in America. What are we going to do? But the Treasury said, you can charge as much as you want for oil. This is great. That enables the American oil companies to make a lot more money on their oil, our oil here, but all the money that you get from these higher prices, you have to recycle into the United States, into the U.S. stock market or real estate market or bond market. And if you don't recycle all of your oil earnings, that will be an act of war. And we will invade you, and there will be a regime change. So from 1975 through today, America's always held the military arm over Saudi Arabia. So the fact is, Saudi Arabia, if it were to sell all the three-quarters of a trillion in treasury bonds, what's it going to do with this? What currency will it move into? The United States would treat it as an act of war, and you can be sure that finally the Saudis and the Wahhabis backers would have a regime change. All of a sudden, the democracy abroad would spread to the Palestinian groups that are the majority of workers in Saudi Arabia, and you'd have a regime change.
All right, fair enough. We've got about 30 seconds left. Just hold up the book again, Killing the Host, and it's a topic dear to my heart, basically that the financial sector is a parasite, and they're so avarice and corrupt, they're killing the host, correct?
Yes, we discussed that last time you were in New York, and that's why we're not getting out of the depression we're in. There's debt deflation, and the book is really about how the failure to cancel debts after 2008 left the U.S. and European economies in debt deflation, and we're not going to get out of it as long as the money's paid for to service debt instead of to buy goods and services.
All right, fair enough. Dr. Michael Hudson, thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
You know, a lot of you people out there, maybe not a lot of you don't think that the National Socialists in Germany, World War II or World War I, used Jews. Well, I've told you before some of the spies used in France were all Jews, female prostitutes. Yeah, don't tell me the National Socialists didn't work with Jews. Well, anyhow, let's go down. We've got another one here I want to tell you about before I go. On February 6, 1937, the SIS, the British Secret Intelligence Service, popularly known as MI6, wrote a report headlined Nazi Activities in Northern Africa. Part of the report was forwarded to the British Internal Security Organization, MI5, some 2 weeks later. The information from the SIS came from a German informant in Paris who claimed to be working for German emigre organizations sending volunteers to Spain, which was at the time engulfed in a bloody civil war. According to the informant, the Nazis had set up headquarters in the city of Ceuta, a Spanish plot of land in North Africa bordering Morocco. The chief Nazi agent in Morocco was, according to the same source, a certain von Roland, whom the informant claimed worked closely with Nazi organization in Seville and Lisbon, and also with the Italian fascist group in Tunis, responsible for the anti-French agitation in that territory. It had been 11 years since MI5 had last heard about Baron von Roland, the man who first appeared in the British security files at the end of World War I, where he had been a German agent for the Abteilung 3B, the Imperial German Military Intelligence. What the MI5 already knew was that the Baron who allegedly had reappeared in North Africa was neither a Baron, nor a Von, nor a Roland, but a Slovakian Jew with the name of Isaac Mizrahi, or in some instances, Israti. Viewing this file, which runs from 1918 to 1947, there is no doubt that he served the Germans loyally in both world wars. And then from the 1930s almost until the end of the war, he worked for the military intelligence of National Socialist Germany, the Abwehr. The fake Baron was born in Salonika, or Salonika, or in its modern form, Thessaloniki. Oh, some of these words. April 15, 1893, his father, Ilua Israti, was according to his son's file, a highly successful merchant. When little Isaac was born, the Jewish community in the city consisted of some 60,000. Salonika at the time was an integrated part of the Ottoman Empire, and thus he was born a Turkish subject. Although the Jewish presence in Salonika can be traced back to antiquity via St. Paul's epistle to the Thessalonians in the New Testament, which you can't depend on, the modern Jewish community was a direct result of the Jewish expulsion from Spain in 1492. Indeed, the Ottoman census of the city merely 14 years later did not record any Jews in the city at all. Among the Sephardic community, then remnant of the Iberian Peninsula, lingered on in the Jewish tongue of Ladino, which was far less removed in time from contemporary Spanish than its Ashkenazi equivalent, Yiddish, was from German. Both communities had a presence in the city, though the Sephardic community was dominant. To what extent von Rollen really was involved in the spy network in North Africa remains an open question. The informant in Paris might have fed the British old information or mere rumors, at least if his movements during the 30s are to be believed. According to a post-war statement, he was in Spain in 31 and 33 and in 34 and 35 before he headed north to Denmark in 36. The following 2 years he spent traveling in South and Central America before he left Europe for good in 39 to what was to become his final destination for the duration of the war. The British, meanwhile, were in the dark about his movements, and the last pre-war report on him contained conflicting information that he had either returned to Spain or gone to South America. Interesting. Apart from an attempt to trace him in Spain, in 41, the file remained silent until September 43. Although MI5 kept him on the watch list, they did not manage to find out very much about what he was up to during the 30s. Yet there is no doubt that von Rollen was on the paybooks of the Abwehr Nazis, more or less from the day that Canaris became head of the organization. Of course, Canaris was a traitor. Canaris had not forgotten the young man he met in Barcelona 20 years earlier. According to the fake Baron, Canaris was also the only man in Germany who knew I came from Jewish origins. The task of Canaris' Jewish spy was to send confidential reports that went directly to the head of the Abwehr about the political situation in the countries where they were sojourning. He also reported on political parties and what military equipment could be sold. His main task was to establish front companies who could serve the Abwehr financial transactions. One of these front companies, Transmar, was founded in late 35 or early 36, had many branches both in Europe and in the Americas. A second one, Scandinavian Overseas Trading Company, set up during his stay in Denmark, was entirely his, but it also had an Abwehr Nazi connection, although the local director, a Mr. Wall, did not know that it was a front company for German intelligence. By the outbreak of World War II in September 39, von Rollen had moved to Argentina. Here he kept working with Transmar, although the latter claimed to have known little of the inner workings of the company in Europe. Under the guidance of von Rollen, Transmar dealt both in imports and exports. The exports consisted mainly of copper and bronze in bulk, which was sent to Germany. All the contact that Canaris went through the German embassy in Buenos Aires. After the war, he would claim that his contact with the company faded about 43, just around the time that the British got another lead on the Baron's whereabouts. In September 43, the British established that he lived in a house in Cali Diagonal in Argentinian capital. However, the interest in their old World War I acquaintance increased 2 months later in November when the notorious Yugoslav triple agent Dusan Popov, codenamed Tricycle, provided the British with information that von Rohlen was a personal friend of Canaris. A Spanish agent working for the Gestapo, Perez Garcia, confirmed that von Rohlen was a German spy after he was captured on board a ship and brought for interrogation to MI5 secret camp 020. I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to have this and send it out to some of our close study friends. But just to let you know that this thing about the Nazis hating all Jews and persecuting all Jews is bullshit. They had many of them in their military and even high command and in their spy network. So these were righteous Jews, I guess, like the JDL calls the Christians, righteous Christians. These are righteous Jews, or as Rockwell used to call them, tame Jews. Well, that's about it for Freya's Day here in the bunker. Female wolf, she-wolf day. I'll be back with you on Monday and see if we can dig up some more crap. I mean, good stuff. I never know what you like the most because you don't give me too much feedback on that, so I just go around and pick up what I can and hope you like it, okay?
He says the 126 texts that he studied were all written in the period during or soon after the supposed existence of Jesus of Nazareth. And Polkovich, the historian, says that had this man existed, somebody surely would have heard of him or written something. You know, somebody as famous as Jesus, but there's no mention. Polkovich said, he writes in his synopsis of his research, he writes, quote, "When I considered those 126 writers, all of whom should have heard of Jesus but did not, and Paul and Marcion and Athenagoras and Matthew with the tetralogy of opposing Christs, the silence from Qumran and Nazareth and Bethlehem, conflicting Bible stories, and so many other mysteries and omissions, I must conclude that Jesus is a mythical character," end quote. He goes on to say that Jesus of Nazareth was nothing more than an urban or desert legend, like an agglomeration of several evangelic and deluded rabbis who might have existed at the time. Of the writings that he examined, written from the first to third centuries, he found only one book that contained a mention of Jesus, and that was The Jewish Wars. That was a title by Roman historian Josephus Flavius. And that writer claims the whole story of Jesus was completely fabricated. We'll be right back. Jesus was completely fabricated. We'll be right back. Historical researcher Michael Polkovich is claiming that Jesus of Nazareth was a mythical character and never existed, which, you know, would make sense. It doesn't diminish, I don't think, the what has been credited as being the words of this humanist philosopher rabbi from 2,000 years ago, but that's a whole different story. Polkovich, the researcher, says even in the Bible, Paul, who is often credited with spreading what would become Christianity, Paul, who wrote all his letters to the various populations in Syria and Turkey, during that time, that Paul never refers to Jesus as a real person. Polkovich writes, quote, "Paul is unaware of the Virgin Mother, He's ignorant of Jesus's nativity, his parentage, his life events, his ministry, his miracles, his apostles, his betrayal, his trial, and his harrowing passion. Paul knows neither where nor when Jesus lived and considers the crucifixion metaphorical. End quote. Well, that's true. If you read Paul's letters to the Thessalonians or Paul's letters to the Romans or all the different books in the New Testament where Paul is writing to spread Christianity, you find that that's true. Palkovich also says that that silence from the Jesus character himself is telling, with no personal accounts being written. Palkovich says, quote, "Perhaps the most bewildering silent one is the mythical super savior himself, Jesus, the Son of God, ostensibly sent on a suicide mission to save us from the childish notion of Adam's transgression, as we learn from Romans, the book of Romans." He adds, "The Jesus character is a phantom of a wisp of a personage who never wrote anything." So add one more to Palkovich's list of writers who never mentioned Jesus, and that would be Jesus himself. He goes on, Palkovich, he writes, "Christian Father Marcion of Pontus in 144 CE denied any virgin birth or childhood for the Jesus infant. He says the circumcision of Jesus was a lie, as well as the crucifixion." And this was a Christian person, I guess. I guess that's what Michael Palkovich is writing here. He goes on to say, "Reading the works of 2nd century Christian Father Athenagoras, one never encounters the word Jesus. Athenagoras was thus unacquainted with the name of his Savior, it would seem." End quote. Palkovich also claims, "Even the book of Mark in the Bible, which contains the story of Jesus' resurrection, was doctored later after Mark wrote it." Palkovich says the original booklet, given the name Mark, ended at chapter 16, verse 8, and later forgers added the fanciful resurrection tale. He adds, "Millions have heard of the Jesus crucifixion with its astral enchantments, zombie armies, and meteorological marvels recorded not by any historian, but only in the dubitable scriptures scribbled decades later by superstitious yokels." Woo! Anyway, this guy, Michael Palkovich, his views surely will prove very controversial, it says here in the Mail Online, as most scholars do not support the theory that Jesus never existed. Most agree that he was a Galilean Jew born between 7 to 4 B.C., and who died in 30 to 36 A.D. It is also widely agreed that he was baptized by John the Baptist and crucified on the order of the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. Now, can you imagine the condemnation that this historian, Michael Palkovich, is getting as a result of, you know, what he considers to be his research? And if you go to the Mail Online, you can see the list of writers from that time. He lists them all, who never mentions Jesus of Nazareth or uses the celestial title Christ. It's just not there. And again, you know, you take it for what it's worth, but Palkovich makes a point. If there was somebody wandering around, some rabbi wandering around the Middle East 2,000 years ago, raising people from the dead and walking on the water and multiplying food for thousands of people sitting by the Sea of Galilee, and who you know, miraculously rises from the dead and so on and so forth, surely, somebody would have written about it. There had to have been an equivalent of a Wolf Blitzer all those years ago.